welcome to In the Studio. For three decades now, the first-person stories of and by the greatest rock musicians in history. I'm Redbeard, your conductor on this rock and roll train. And today, in the studio, it's the conclusion of the anniversary look at one of the most acclaimed double albums in rock history.
Harmony.
I think Yellow Brick Road was a melting pot of everything. I think it had basically, if you want to say it, you know, something for everybody, you know.
It did, though.
It was
right,
like it was like a department store, you know. If you wanted the hard rock thing, it's over here with Funeral for a Friend and Love Lies Bleeding, you know. There was stuff like Sweet Painted Ladies, you know, there was great ballads. It was a huge, broad canvas, and I think it was a combination of everything from the past and everything to come.
Candles burned out long before your legend ever be.
I'm Elton John, in the studio for Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
This is Bernie Taupin, in the studio for the anniversary of Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
When Rolling Stone magazine writers chose their top 500 albums of all time, they ranked Elton John's October 1973 double album, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, at number 91. Britain's esteemed Q magazine rated it even higher on their best ever list at number 84. But with actual sales of over 20 million copies worldwide, Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road has entered into the super elite top 10 most popular albums in the world. In 1973, the songwriting team of composer Elton John and lyricist Bernie Taupin were on a tear. Even at the pace of two albums annually, Elton and Bernie found themselves with more than enough A material for producer Gus Dudgeon. Lyricist Bernie Taupin joined me in the studio to recall writing and recording Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Very fond memories of making that record, you know, because it was done in France at the Chateau d'Aiville. And you know, it was a wonderful place and a wonderful space in time. You know, I mean, a very sort of eccentric place to make an album. You know, with its ghosts and its legends. You know,
Tell me.
Well, the chateau was actually the place where Chopin had his affair with Jorsin, and legend has it that she still haunts it. And it was a very, very bizarre place. I mean, I had an incredibly strange experience there one night. Not actually during the making of that particular record. It was later on when I went back to actually make a record, produce a record with another band. But we had a pretty strange night one night.
Did you share it with?
Well, you know how everybody says, do you believe in the supernatural? You know, and you say, well, not until it happens to me. And it really did that one night. I mean, some really scary went down, basically. I mean, you know, fire starting in fireplaces that weren't lit, and mirrors being scratched from the inside out, and cats going, like, crawling up curtains, and it was just really weird voices going on tape that weren't there.
Oh, come on.
And phantom hands in the studio, like, you know, touching you on. It was really, I mean, honest to God, that, and apparently, although I've never talked to her about it, apparently Stevie Nicks had the same experience, although I don't know if hers was induced by anything else, I'm not sure, but no, apparently they did have some experience there, the same thing, but the people that worked there were a little odd too. There used to be this kind of odd character who was sort of a caretaker that used to play the double bass on his balcony under the full moon, you know, and sort of had nylons tied all down the fret, and it was pretty bizarre. It was a pretty eccentric place.
Thank you.
Elton John talks about the song Funeral for a Friend.
Well, I didn't play any of that in fanfare. It was done by the engineer, David Henschel. In those days, it was an ARP synthesizer that was very, very small. And it's one of those things that looks like a telephone operator would use in the old days, where you didn't, you know, patch things in. And it was, I mean, he did that off his own back. I never listened to it. He just composed that fanfare and intro off his own back. And our first I heard of it was when Gus was mixing. He said, listen to what Dave's done before the actual track. And it was just, that's brilliant. And that synthesizer, all that was all done and composed by Dave Henschel. Well, he just works various themes, like the Candle in the Wind themes in there in the intro. I mean, amazing. And on the synthesizer, it was just so small, quite incredible.
Thank you.
There may not be a more dramatic example of the power of Elton John and Bernie Taupin's songwriting team than the opening medley on the album Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, called Funeral for a Friend and Love Lies Bleeding. Bernie Taupin comments,
"I've always loved the fury of that song because there's something angry in that song, but it's very passionate at the same time. And it's one of those songs that always makes me go, yeah, you know, it's like you feel the kick when it goes. And I mean, it's a real, that song, you know, lots of people don't really get into that particular song and try and understand it, but it's basically, you know, about how rock and roll can tear a family apart. And you feel that. It's just basically the, you know, saying that a guitar can strip you of everything, you know, if you're in love with it more than anything else. And that happens. The road kills families, it kills relationships, but at the same time, It's the best heart that beats, man. There's nothing like it, you know? And that's what that song projects, you know, for me.
Only 18 months before, Elton John released the Goodbye Yellow Brick Road double album, guitarist Davey Johnston joined the band. I asked Bernie Taupin's opinion on Davey's impact.
Personally, I think Davey had a great impact on the band because, well, number one, which was really interesting about Davey, was the fact that he never really played electric before.
Really?
Yeah, well, his roots were in folk music, and he was in a band called Magna Carta. In fact, Davey came to the band basically through me, because when I made a spoken word album like in 1970 with musical background to it. And I had people like Sean Phillips on it and, you know, Caleb Quay and Davey was on it. And that was through Gus Dudgeon, I think, because Gus Dudgeon used to record Magna Carta. And so when the idea came of filling out the band and putting a guitar player in the band, Davey basically had to bluff his way in and say, sure, I can play electric. And I guess he took to it like a duck to water. But I think one of the things that Davey really brought to the band that was advantageous was his command of commanding. You know, he was very good at being a band leader. You know, I mean, he knew how to work with other musicians, and obviously he's become that now. You know, he's Elton's musical director, basically. So, and he was extremely talented. I mean, he could really play anything. He was one of those people that could pick something up and just be able to play it, you know. And I think he must have had a fine sense of confidence. But it really stretched Elton. It filled the band out. It made us have, obviously, a more powerful sound. And I think that's sort of where we changed directions with the band. You know, that's when we got into those kind of sort of rock and roll things that really paid off. You know, I guess in a way he was sort of, you know, in the early days, a bit of the Keith Richard of the band. You know, he was great at coming up with licks. You know, you think of Saturday Night and Bitches Back. They have those great riffs to them. That was all Davey, you know. My bulldog is barking in the backyard, enough to raise the dead man from his grave. And I can't concentrate on what I'm doing. Disturbance gonna crucify my day. We'll be right back.
social disease.
With banjo and electric guitar by Davy Johnston, that's called Social Disease from Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. Coming up next, Elton and Bernie reminisce about their early fascination with all things American, and later the phenomenon and the circumstances surrounding the remake of Candle in the Wind. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Elton John and Bernie Taupin for the anniversary of Goodbye Yellow Brick Road Part 2.
Welcome back. I'm Elton John in the studio for Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
This is Bernie Taupin in the studio for the anniversary of Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road Part 2.
And I'm Redbeard. Elton John has watched carefully over the years while his career has unfolded as one of rock's biggest success stories. Elton John takes precautions not to be blinded by the glare of celebrity.
In this business, you have to have something other than this business. I mean, Bernie's always had his writing and his interests, and he's always had other interests apart from just writing lyrics and rock and roll. Although it's been a part of my, one of the things I didn't sell at my auction was my record collection. But that's important. I couldn't have done that. That would have been stupid. Music means too much to me. But you have to have another interest. I have my soccer team. I have other interests in. We learn about as we become successful with our money that we've had. We've learned a lot of things as well. And if you don't have that other interest, rock and roll is wonderful, I love it, and it's the only thing I've really ever been interested in doing and playing music, but it's not everything.
Come over and see me, come over and please.
say if I give you my number, will you promise to call me? Wait till my husband's away.
Great Bernie Taupin line, like acting in a movie when you've got the wrong part. Here's the lyricist Bernie Taupin.
That was the first lesbian rock and roll song, I think, you know, way before it became, you know, chic. Long before it became chic. I don't know. I think it was a product of a dirty mind, actually. You know, I had this kind of, you know, Catholic school mentality, you know, of sort of frustrated girls in grey pleated skirts, you know, not being able to find the affection elsewhere or at home. And I just got carried away with it, I think. Basically it is. I mean, it was kind of a randy song, you know, and it was even made even more so by the way it was treated, you know, because it's a very raw track, you know, I mean, the guitar on it and everything. And I mean, I brought in all the sicko fantasies into it, you know, sort of the nuns and the whole thing, you know. So, you know, that's the thing. That's the funny thing. I mean, I think we did so much of that back then, and nobody, you know.
And got away with it.
We got away with it. You know, nobody expected us to do it, or nobody kind of got it, you know, because we were, I mean, God, we were doing drug references and, you know, talking about smack and heroin way back on, like, stuff like, you know, Madman Across the Water, you know. I mean, things like Rotten Peaches and you know, it was pretty down and dirty stuff, you know, and I don't think people quite realize that, you know. I mean,
no.
There's lots of stuff. I mean, I think a lot of our early stuff was very sexual, you know. I mean, really sexual. And I think that was because I was young.
Well, I was going to say, look at the age.
I was really young in those days. And, you know, the sexual revolution was going on in my head as I was out on the road, you know. I mean, I was making all those fantasies a reality in my life as well as in the songs. And they were, you know, I mean, if you counted the amount of hookers I've talked about in our songs, it's unbelievable. I always had that fascination for the underbelly, the dark underbelly of things. And, you know, everything, we wrote about it so much, you know, and because it was fascinating. It was much more, you know, the Black Knight is so much more interesting than the White Knight, you know. I mean, he's a cooler guy. And I always related to that whole thing, that great scene, you know, in Blue Velvet, you know, when David Lynch pans under the ground and you see all the worms and, you know, you see the beautiful, you know, the Dalmatian and the fire engine and the white picket fence.
The green grass.
And then he pans down under the earth and you see all the maggots and the worms, man. That was such a cool kind of dichotomy. And that's what fascinated me with writing, you know. I loved creating characters, and a lot of those characters came, you know, whether from docksides or bars or, you know, the Bowery or, you know, it was kind of that American fascination that I had.
I'm back on dry land once again. Opportunity awaits me like a rat in the drain. We're all hunting honey with money to burn. Just a short time to show you the tricks that we. If the boys all behave themselves here,
Proving that double albums were hardly enough room to hold the prolific songwriting duo of Elton John and Bernie Taupin. That's called Sweet Painted Lady. That's on the deluxe edition of Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and you can find a whole lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. Coming up next, the composers of the top-selling song of all time, In the Studio, for the conclusion of Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Part 2.
Welcome back. I'm Elton John, in the studio for Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
This is Bernie Taupin, in the studio for the anniversary of Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Part 2.
And I'm Redbeard. Of Elton John's first dozen albums, Gus Dudgeon produced all but the very first one. In fact, most of the musicians on Goodbye Yellow Brick Road had been with Elton John on at least three previous albums.
When we're talking about this album, let's not dismiss that the musicianship by Nigel Olsen, Dee Murray and David Johnson, plus the backing vocal, is just second to none. I mean, their backing vocal, they were the best backing vocalists of any band, and you can't talk about Yellow Brick Road without mentioning the fact that they were absolutely superb musicians. And very much a part of my sound, Nigel's drumming especially.
The song on Goodbye Yellow Brick Road called The Ballad of Danny Bailey actually includes a birth date and a death date in parentheses, sparking intrigue over whether this song is based on true historical figure. Here's the lyricist, who should know, Bernie Taupin.
I thought it might pull them in a bit more and make people think, who is this character? You know, I've heard of Pretty Boy Floyd, and I've heard of Babyface Nelson and John Dillinger. Who's Danny Bailey, you know? And, I mean, it was totally based on those characters, you know? I mean, I kind of had a fascination with that whole Bonnie and Clyde kind of thing, you know, and the killing of John Dillinger and stuff. I think it was more based on John Dillinger than anything else, you know. I just thought it was a cool story, you know. I wanted to write a story about a sort of, you know, guy running white lightning, you know, through the back roads of Arkansas or something like that, who moved on and, you know, took it one step at a time and met, you know, the fateful end. So it was almost Pulp Fiction.
Some punk with a shotgun killed young Danny Bailey in cold blood in the lobby of a downtown motel. Killed him in anger, a force he couldn't handle. Help pull the trigger that cut short his life. And there's the running short of heroes back up here in the hills. Without Danny Bailey, we're gonna have to break up our stills. So mark his grave well, 'cause Kentucky loved him. Born and raised a proper, I guess life just bugged him. And he found faith in danger, a lifestyle he lived by.
Elton John has high praise for his lyricists of so many years, Bernie Taupin.
Now I think I'm a much better singer than I used to be, and I'm a singer who plays a piano rather than a piano player who sings. And you can leave his lyrics alone and then come back and sing them, like Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, which we did in Australia. Great song, great lyrics. I mean, you can sing that in Australia. When I was going through a bad time, every night I sang that, I was choking back on the words, because it still meant as much. It was still fresh lyrically. And I think, you know, his lyrics don't date. That's why Candle in the Wind was a hit the second time around, because it's still a great lyric. And, you know, that's the biggest tribute I can say as a singer. I never get fed up with singing his lyrics. In fact, the more I sing them, some of them, the nicer the song gets.
This double album was secure in rock history, but no one could have imagined the epilogue that would be written in the late summer of 1997, when a real-life princess who survived scandal only to lead many humanitarian projects around the world would perish in a fatal car crash. When funeral arrangements for Diana, Princess of Wales, were being made, Elton John and lyricist Bernie Taupin found themselves drawn into the vortex of enormous worldwide grief through the song Candle in the Wind from the original Goodbye Yellow Brick Road album.
And then, of course, the unfortunate third rebirth of it, which is basically born out of tragedy and is not something to be really joyous about, except for the fact that out of the tragedy, you know, I think people need to realize that the amount of money that it's generated for Diana's trust fund is pretty phenomenal.
So it's nothing to do with this. I mean, of course, I'm absolutely gratified that it's become the biggest selling single of all time. Not necessarily because my name is going to be in the Guinness Book of Records, but the more it sells, the more good it's going to do. You know, and I think more people have to kind of realize that. There's a lot of negativity out there these days.
And, you know, as I've said, the thin ice of compassion melts very quickly. I mean, people are so easy, you know, it's so easy to negate it and call it profiteering. I mean, I don't really see where the profiteering is in it, you know. I mean, he was requested to do it by the palace. And, you know, it's not something you're going to turn down for one of your dearest friends, you know. So when I had the opportunity to rework it, I mean, yeah, it was a horribly difficult task. And I don't really remember too much about doing it. I just remember the enormity of the effort and what it entailed. And I'm glad I didn't really think about the outcome of it, because it would have made it even harder, I think, you know. But it's a pretty awesome kind of responsibility to rewrite completely the lyrics of something that is so universally well known, you know, and to make it believable again. And God willing, it seemed to have worked, you know. But it will remain as a very, very special part in my life, I think. In fact, it was, I believe, one of Diana's sons, I can't remember which one. When they contacted him, he contacted me. He said, I've been asked to perform. He said, they're playing Candle in the Wind on the radio in England all the time. What do you think about that? And I got the impression from that was, do we work on this song and rework it a little bit? Or are you saying you want me to write a song that is reminiscent of Candle in the Wind? And there was some sort of discrepancy about that. I'm not quite sure what happened. But I basically went away, listened to the original track, and suddenly realized that there was absolutely no way that I could use any of the existing lyric except maybe, and you lived your life like a candle in the wind. That was about it. You know, I realized I had to rewrite the whole thing. So that was formidable enough, you know. But, you know, once I kind of thought about it, the hardest bit was the opening, you know, Goodbye Norma Jean, how do I change this? And I came up with the idea of, you know, England's Rose. And once I got that, it all seemed to come together fairly quickly. And basically, it did pour out. And I was very, one thing I remember being very concerned about was that it didn't sound like a singular salute from me, that it sounded like an outpouring of grief from whatever nation in the world, the nations of the world that felt strongly about it. I wanted it to be an every man's song or an every woman's song.
It's an immense mantle, though, to bear as the lyricist.
Well, and plus, I didn't want to appear pompous by being, you know, and saying this is my feeling and mine only.
And
you know,
it's not
so,
a movie, and it's right. All too real at the time. It's your writing.
I mean, I didn't even think that sort of 2.5 billion people were going to be watching it a week later, you know. So basically, I did it, and I sent it to him, and he was pretty overwhelmed with it, and performed it, I thought, with impeccable grace and great taste, and did a magnificent job. And it has become what it has become. You know, the thinking was beforehand that what would happen is that the broadcast would get pirated.
We would have.
Yeah.
I can tell you right
it
now.
It would have been pirated, and unless we'd go, and what he did was he went straight from the funeral to George Martin's studio, the church, that's what the studio is called, and recorded it straight away. So he recorded it right after the funeral because they wanted to get it out as soon as possible. And if that sounds calculated, well, it's really not, because obviously the whole idea was to immediately start, you know, making her trust fund, you know, a reality. And we had to do that because it did get pirated anyway. Radio stations were playing, you know, the broadcast. And, you know, he wanted to do a really, really definitive version of it, which, you know, as wonderful as the performance was in the church, for a long-standing tribute and to do, it was very necessary to do a pure version of it in the studio. And he basically said, you know, that's the last time I'm going to perform it. And he's been true to his words. And he said the only time that he would ever perform it again is if he was requested to do it by one of her sons.
Goodbye, England's Rose. May you ever grow in our hearts. You were the grace that placed itself where lives were torn apart. Called out to our country, you whispered to those in pain, now you belong to heaven, and the stars spell out your name. And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never fading with the sunset when the rain set in. And your footsteps will always fall here along England's greenest hills. Your candles burned out long before your legend ever will. We've lost these empty days without your smile. This torch we'll always carry for our nation's golden child. And even though we try, the truth brings us to tears. All our words cannot express the joy you brought us through the years. And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never fading with the sunset when rain set in. And your footsteps will always fall here along England's greenest hills. Your candles burned out long before your legend. A country lost without your soul, who missed the wings of your compassion more than you'll ever know. And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never fading with the sunset when the rain set in. And your footsteps will always candles burned out long before your legend ever will. Your footsteps will always fall here along England's greenest hills. Your candles burned out long before your legend ever will.
I definitely think that access to celebrities has got way out of hand, and I think the whole media generation has got out of hand. I mean, there are no sacred cows anymore. I mean, it's just it's basically a feeding frenzy out there. And the one thing I can honestly say is that I could never and never would have wanted to be the other way around. I would never have wanted to be in Elton's position. I mean, he was made for that. And I think he's been able to manage, to a certain extent, to rise above it, you know, to rise above cynical scrutiny. I mean, he's always managed to carry himself with great dignity, I think. And I think that stems out of his honesty. And I don't know if that answers your question about my feelings about him. I mean, I have always been extremely happy with my lot in life and how I am perceived by the public. You know, I've always felt that I've got my fair shake, you know, but there is a point where access to your
It's almost like people are prying at your inner thoughts these days, that nothing, as I say, nothing is sacred. This is a subject that you could talk about for hours, you know, because it's so vast, you know, and where we're going with it, I don't know. I mean, it's very difficult to ascertain, you know.
That was Elton John lyricist Bernie Taupin. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests Elton John and Bernie Taupin. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet, theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.